Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
More survivors of the Club Q shooting are sharing their stories. And this morning, we're learning more about the suspected gunman's past. Meanwhile, there is yet another deadly mass shooting in America, this time at a Walmart in Virginia. We'll have the latest on that developing story in just a moment. Also ahead, former President Donald Trump runs out of legal options to block the release of his tax returns. But it doesn't mean this years-long legal fight is over just yet. Good morning, and welcome to Way Too Early on this Wednesday, November 23rd. I'm Jonathan Lemire. Thanks for starting your day with us. And we're going to begin with yet another mass shooting in the United States of America. Shots rang out just after 10 o'clock last night at a Walmart in the city of Chesapeake, Virginia, located in the southeast corner of the state, just outside of Norfolk. Police confirmed within the last hour that seven people are dead, including the gunman. It's unclear at this moment if the gunman took his own life or if he was killed by responding officers. Police say victims are being treated at multiple hospitals in the area. A spokesperson for the area's top trauma center told local reporters that five patients were being treated there. The FBI was on the scene last night, and the ATF from Washington tweeted just after midnight that its agents are also assisting in the investigation. We will bring with you any developments in this story as the morning continues. Meanwhile, the accused Colorado Springs nightclub shooter will be in court today. The 22-year-old is facing five counts of first-degree murder and five counts of bias-motivated crimes. In court filings yesterday, defense attorneys stated that Anderson Lee Aldridge is non-binary and uses the they-them pronouns. We also learned that the 22-year-old's birth name was Nicholas Franklin Brink, but that was changed back in 2016. The Denver Post found court records that give a reason for the change. Aldrich's grandparents, who were their guardians at the time, said Aldrich wanted to change their name to protect themselves from their birth father. The Washington Post has more insight on what appears to be a troubled childhood for the suspected shooter. Both parents have arrest records, and before the name change, the Post reports that Aldrich was the target of vicious online bullying. In June of last year, Aldrich was arrested for making a bomb threat. This Ring camera video footage was provided to NBC News by the woman who owned their home. No bomb was ever found, and Aldrich surrendered to police after an hours-long standoff. Aldrich was charged with kidnapping and felony menacing, but there are no records that show the case was ever prosecuted. In other headlines, the Supreme Court has cleared the way for House Democrats to finally access Donald Trump's tax returns. It's a major loss for the former president, who has sought to shield those records from the House Ways and Means Committee for many years. The decision came in a brief one-page order that noted there were no dissenting votes. This means the House Ways and Means Committee, which has been seeking Trump's tax documents since 2019, can try to access the materials before Republicans take over the House in January. While Committee Chairman Richard Neal celebrated the decision, the top Republican on the panel, Congressman Kevin Brady, accused the Supreme Court of, quote, opening a dangerous new political battleground where no citizen is safe. Attorneys for former President Trump have asked a federal court in Florida to provide them with a complete version of the affidavit that federal investigators used to obtain a search warrant for Trump's Mar-a-Lago home and club in Florida last August. Prosecutors are conducting a criminal investigation into the retention of government records at Mar-a-Lago after Trump's presidency ended. A redacted version of the search warrant affidavit was made public in late August. In their court filing yesterday, Trump's attorneys said they and their client must be able to review the document to know whether their rights to reasonable search and seizure were violated. Trump publicly called for the affidavit to be unsealed back in August, but yesterday's filing was the first time his lawyers formally filed to unseal the redacted version. Meantime, The Guardian reports the 11th District Court of Appeals may be inclined to agree with the Justice Department to end the special master review of documents the FBI seized from Mar-a-Lago for potential privilege protections. During a hearing yesterday, the three-judge panel appeared skeptical that former President Trump should get special treatment and be able to undercut a criminal investigation because of his status as a former president. An attorney for Trump argued his client's status as a former president was the reason why the case was extraordinary and warranted the appointment of a special master. Judge Raymond Deary, you'll recall, was appointed as that special master to sort through the documents and is expected to complete his review next month. Joining us now is the author of that Guardian piece, political investigations reporter for The Guardian, Hugo Lowell. Hugo, great to see you this morning. Thanks for being here. So tell us more about why this panel of judges appeared inclined to end the special review, special master's review of the documents.
Yeah, so the 11th Circuit really went back to fundamental principles in this case yesterday. And they were basically trying to figure out if there was any instance in which the judicial branch should be able to interfere in an executive branch investigation even before charges had been filed. And I think Trump's lawyers really struggled with this yesterday because their only argument was to say, well, you know, Trump is a former president and this is why he should get special treatment. And that really didn't seem to convince the three-panel judge in Atlanta. And I think he had an added disadvantage because two of the three judges were part of an earlier ruling where they said the trial judge in this case, who appointed the special master, abused her discretion in giving Trump his request. And so I think it's looking like a very bad day for Trump's lawyers.
So, Hugo, it's been a little bit since we've had an update in this case. So just refresh viewers' memories. And there's often a lot of legalese and jargon tossed around. Strip all that out. Just explain to us why this is important.
Yeah, look, I mean, this all started with the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago in August. You know, weeks after that search happened, Trump decided he needed to get on the docket. He needed to have some sort of judicial action in this. And so he applied for a special master, sounds like an independent arbiter, to go through the documents, basically to see if there was anything that was privileged, that was, you know, his communications with his lawyers or documents that were part of executive privilege from when he was in the White House, and try and remove that from the evidence cache that federal investigators had developed. And so this is where the special master comes in. He wanted the special master to say, yes, these documents or certain documents cannot be introduced as evidence in the event of a prosecution. And, well, we've got to this point where the DOJ has said, well, this is ridiculous. We haven't even filed charges yet. There's no way a former president or anyone should be able to undercut a criminal investigation in this way. And so this is why the DOJ appealed, and the 11th Circuit seems poised to grant that.
And, of course, just in the last few days, the Department of Justice appointed a special counsel to review this investigation, as well as the January 6th insurrection and Trump's role there in trying to overturn the 2020 election. So walk us through now. What happens next? Now that this is happening here with the special master, what are the next steps and what sort of timeline might we be watching?
Look, the special counsel is basically going to take over an active investigation, right? Especially with the Mar-a-Lago documents investigation. You know, the special counsel is going to set up his own team. He's going to have his own office. But he's also inheriting a lot of work that the Justice Department has done, the National Security Division has done in the kind of preceding 4 or 5 months. And so when he gets up to speed, and, you know, we expect him to get up to speed relatively fast, it's not a very complicated case. You know, it's about the willful retention of national defense information. It's also about potential obstruction of justice and kind of concealment of government records at Mar-a-Lago. Once he's brought up to speed on this, it could be a very short runway until he decides, you know, is this basically sufficient evidence to charge any crimes? That's the first point. The second point he has to consider is, if I do bring charges, am I going to do it in conjunction with charges over January 6th, or am I just going to, you know, barrel ahead with the Mar-a-Lago documents case?
All right. Well, great reporting, as always, from Hugo Lowell, political investigation reporter for The Guardian. And we're going to talk to you again a little later on Morning Joe. Still ahead here on Way Too Early, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo doubles down on his concerning rhetoric about America's teachers. Plus, the second woman to accuse Georgia Senate nominee Herschel Walker of pressuring her into having an abortion, she's coming forward with new evidence. Those stories and a check on the weather when we come right back.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Hey friends, want to grow your business faster and stronger? Wondering how to find and keep top talent? It starts with your culture. Insperity, a leading HR provider, can help your business create a culture that drives growth. Download their free ebook, The Future of Business is Culture, at Insperity.com. With the right people, processes, and values in place, your company can realize its full potential. Visit Insperity.com to see how Insperity provides HR that makes a difference.
Welcome back to Way Too Early. Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is doubling down on his criticism of America's teachers. Pompeo posted a tweet yesterday that reads, quote, "Our greatest long-term threat isn't an external enemy. It's teachers' unions that push toxic wokeness on kids instead of teaching real American history, reading, and math." The tweet came a day after Pompeo's interview with Semaphore, where he called Randy Weingarten, the head of the American Federation of Teachers Union, the most dangerous person in the world. Not Vladimir Putin, not Kim Jong-un, Randy Weingarten. Semaphore reached out to Weingarten for her response. She said Pompeo was, quote, "desperate to be labeled as the extremist in the Republican presidential primary." She added, quote, "he's flooding the zone with disinformation. And what's dangerous about that is that it will lead to violence. He's decided to use his campaign to foment hate and division." Randy Weingarten will be a guest coming up later today on Morning Joe. Meanwhile, a woman who says Georgia Republican Senate nominee Herschel Walker pressured her to have an abortion has come forward with more evidence to support her claims. Appearing at a press conference yesterday, the woman, who was identified only as Jane Doe, shared recordings of a phone call and a voicemail allegedly sent to her by Walker, who was her former boyfriend.
You, this is your platform calling you big sex puppy. You can't believe you're not in. I will talk to you later. You be sweet. Bye-bye.
The woman came forward last month after another of Walker's former girlfriends also accused him of paying for her to have an abortion. Walker has denied the claims of both women, even referring to the second Jane Doe, who he can be seen photographed with here, as, quote, "some woman I don't know."
Herschel, I was shocked that you deny even knowing me. We were together for 6 years. You met my parents on a number of occasions. You met other members of my family. Surely you remember coming to my apartment in Dallas more times than I can count. Are you really willing to do anything, including lying to the voters in Georgia to become a senator? Do you have the guts to meet with me in person in public? Look me in the eye and tell me to my face that you don't know me and that none of what I just said is true. I'm looking forward to your response.
The runoff in the Georgia Senate election is in 2 weeks. Also in Georgia, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina was interviewed by a special grand jury in Fulton County outside Atlanta yesterday, investigating possible interference in the 2020 presidential election. The Trump ally was questioned for just over 2 hours, according to his office. Graham was subpoenaed for testimony in relation to two calls he made to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger after the 2020 election. Raffensperger has alleged that Graham suggested he had the authority to reject certain legally cast ballots. Graham denies ever having made such a suggestion. The testimony was months in the making, with Graham trying every legal maneuver to have his subpoena quashed. He ultimately was forced to comply after the Supreme Court ruled against him earlier this month. In a statement after the interview, Graham's office said, quote, "he was treated with respect, professionalism, and courtesy," and Graham will not comment on the substance of the questions. Still ahead, we're going to have the latest from the war in Ukraine as Russian forces renew attacks on a key city that they just lost. Plus, more layoffs for big tech. CNBC will join us live with more insight on what the job cuts could mean for the global economy. We'll be right.
Hey, friends. Want to grow your business faster and stronger? Wondering how to find and keep top talent? It starts with your culture. Insperity, a leading HR provider, can help your business create a culture that drives growth. Download their free ebook, The Future of Business is Culture, at Insperity.com. With the right people, processes, and values in place, your company can realize its full potential. Visit Insperity.com to see how Insperity provides HR that makes a difference.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
For goal. Touchdown. Look out here. Shot taken. Goal!
Stunning. That was the goal that put Saudi Arabia ahead of Argentina yesterday, which led to one of, if not the biggest upset in the 92-year history of the World Cup. Saudi Arabia had won only 3 games previously ever at the World Cup, and only one in the last 28 years before yesterday's victory over the two-time champions. Lionel Messi, who had given Argentina the lead before the Saudis came back to win 2-1, is playing at what is likely his last World Cup and chasing the one major title that has eluded him. Argentina in recent decades, finding ways to lose. But cheers rang out across the Arab world, which until yesterday had not seen an Arab country win a game at this tournament, the first World Cup ever to be held in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia's King Salman declared today a public holiday for all workers and students in the kingdom in celebration of that improbable victory. There's also some drama surrounding one of the biggest stars at the World Cup. Portugal captain Cristiano Ronaldo is leaving the Premier League's Manchester United by mutual agreement. The club announced the move yesterday following last week's explosive interview in which Ronaldo criticized the team's manager and ownership. We'll see Ronaldo on the pitch tomorrow as Portugal plays Ghana. Meanwhile, Man U's American owners have confirmed they are open to selling the team, saying in a statement yesterday that the board is commencing a process to explore strategic alternatives for the club. This comes just a week after Liverpool's owners said they might sell as well. And we should note, Team USA's next game, Friday against England. What could be more American than the day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, 1776 all over again. Turning now to the NBA and a heated moment in Phoenix between the Suns and Lakers last night. Lakers guard Patrick Beverley was ejected for shoving Suns center DeAndre Ayton to the floor late in the fourth quarter. Miffed over Ayton taunting a teammate, Beverley body-checked the Suns big man when he wasn't looking. That's pretty cheap. The Suns beat the woeful Lakers 115-105. The top four college football playoff teams remain unchanged for a third straight week, but there's a shakeup among the chasing teams after Tennessee lost to South Carolina Saturday. That moved LSU up to fifth and put USC, Southern California, at number six. Georgia's still number one, followed by Ohio State, Michigan, and TCU. There are two more rankings left, and two games this weekend could create more clarity. Michigan will play at Ohio State this Saturday, while USC hosts Notre Dame. And, of course, there is a slate of NFL games scheduled for tomorrow, Thanksgiving. The Detroit Lions, as they always do, will play on the holiday, as they have it every year the league has held games since 1934. So will the Dallas Cowboys, a Turkey Day staple since 1966. The Lions are hosting the Bills, Cowboys host the Giants, and then in the nightcap, the Minnesota Vikings host your New England Patriots. Time now for the weather. Michelle Grossman is here with the forecast. So today's a big travel day. How's it looking today? And how's it looking tomorrow for the holiday?
It's looking good today. I mean, that's really rare to see a map that looks like this on any given day, let alone Thanksgiving week. So looking really quiet, satellite and radar showing us. We have a few snow showers in the Rockies, a few showers in portions of eastern Texas. And we're also looking at some showers in Florida. We're going to see a stationary front kind of drape there, bringing showers from time to time throughout the day in Florida. Otherwise, we're really quiet. And we're looking at tomorrow. We start to get a little more active tomorrow into the weekend. So tomorrow we'll see that flood risk from Texas to Louisiana and to Arkansas, also portions of Missouri. We could see some heavy rain, snow showers still in the Rockies, lots of sunshine through the West, lots of sunshine through the Great Lakes, the Ohio Valley, into the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic. That's good news. Temperature's really nice, too. 52 in New York City, 58 degrees in D.C. with some sunshine. And then as we near Friday, we could see some heavy snow in portions of Western Texas. We could see some heavy rain in Eastern Texas into Oklahoma, and then heavy rain expanding into portions of the Ohio Valley, the Great Lakes, even into the Northeast. So we start to get a little active in the Northeast on Friday. Now, as far as the parade goes, looking really good. Winds are going to be light, so the balloons are going to fly. Temperature's not bad. May need a layer or two. Definitely need the sunglasses. We're looking at lots of sunshine by 9 o'clock. We're looking at 42. By lunchtime, 49 degrees. So really good. And the travel forecast for today, again, quiet. We're looking at a few showers in Texas and also Florida. Then that's where it gets a little more active tomorrow. It's a little trickier if you're headed out on the roadways tomorrow. Headed off to dinner, we're looking at heavy rain in portions of Texas into Oklahoma, into the Gulf Coast states. That is for Thanksgiving. And then Friday, we're looking at that extending into portions of the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. Back to you.
Michelle Grossman, thank you and happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too.
All right, still ahead here on Way Too Early. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy calls on Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to resign over border issues or face impeachment when the GOP holds the majority next year. We're taking a look at that new threat and what it could mean for the Biden administration when we come right back. Way Too Early. It's a little ahead of 5:30 a.m. on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Jonathan Lemire. Thanks for being with us on this day before Thanksgiving. With his hopes of becoming the next House Speaker on the line, Kevin McCarthy is still trying to lock down the 218 votes he needs to win control of the gavel. Yesterday, McCarthy visited the border in El Paso, Texas, where he attacked the Biden administration's Secretary of Homeland Security, and again revealed what the GOP majority will be focused on in the coming term.
Under Secretary Mayorkas, his deliberate suspensions of our laws have proved deadly. His actions have produced the greatest wave of illegal immigration in recorded history. Our country may never recover from Secretary Mayorkas' dereliction of duty. This is why today, I am calling on the Secretary to resign. He cannot and must not remain in that position. If Secretary Mayorkas does not resign, House Republicans will investigate every order, every action, and every failure will determine whether we can begin impeachment inquiry.
A White House spokesman responded by reminding everyone that McCarthy pulled the same move back in April and suggested that Republicans haven't learned anything from their party's historic underperformance in this month's midterms. According to a Department of Homeland Security official, Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas has no intention of resigning. Joining us now, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, Camila DeChalas. Camila, good morning. Thanks for being with us this morning. Republicans have been hammering on the border, the issue of the border, for a while now, and McCarthy's calls are being seen as an effort to shore up votes as part of the Republican Party. Not everyone's on board with his bid to be Speaker. We have had some high-profile voices in the last few days saying they won't back him. So, two-part question. First, talk to us about the politics of the border. But secondly, tell us about McCarthy's quest to be Speaker. Where does it stand?
So what's really interesting about this is that he's using immigration has been one of the key priorities or issues that really have reunited the base of the Republican Party. Immigration has been a key priority and topic of focus for Trump and others. It's something that's seen as one of their key talking points that they all agree on. And so for him to go to the border and call on Mayorkas to resign, it's not surprising, but it just sends this message maybe to other Republican lawmakers who may be on the fence of supporting him for House speakership, that saying, hey, look, this is one of the key priorities or issues that I want to focus on if I do get in that role. What's really, you know, notable about him going to the border is that he's made it no secret that when GOP, the Republicans do take back control of the House, that they want to begin investigations looking into Biden's immigration policies. They've been highly critical of the policies that he's implemented at the southern border to try to mitigate the unlawful entry there. And so we're really going to see if that's going to have any effectiveness and to, you know, luring more Republican lawmakers to supporting him. Where it stands now is that he is still unclear whether he's going to have enough votes to really secure that position. But you're going to see in the weeks ahead that he's going to make every effort to kind of make this appeal to his colleagues that, hey, put me in this position because this is what I'm planning to do if I do become the House Speaker.
And he still hasn't gotten the official endorsement of Donald Trump for that speaker role either, despite his efforts to court the former president. So it seems like the House GOP is pretty clearly signaling what their tenor is going to be while in charge. It's going to be investigations, investigations, investigations. Doesn't seem like much in the way of space for cooperation on the Biden agenda. Are there voices in the Republican Party, as you talk to lawmakers there, who are worried that going so negative all the time, whether that's about something like this with Mayorkas, we know the Hunter Biden stuff has already started, are they concerned that they're not putting forward any sort of positive agenda and simply dwelling on the negative?
So some Republican lawmakers that I've been talking to in the recent days, I've brought up what is going to happen or what could potentially happen with codifying legislation to secure rights for DACA recipients and put that into federal law. And that is still something that Democrats are secretly really trying to keep pushing, not just for Biden just to sign an executive order, but for something to really be done in Congress. And they know that those chances are looking a little bit more slim now, just given what's happening. But that is something still that some Republican lawmakers do want to see happen. I think it's just a matter of what they're willing to agree on and compromise with. Remember, when Trump was in office, that was something that Democrats and Republicans both tried to come to the table and try to negotiate on. So those are something that's just one of the key issues that we might see in the upcoming weeks or months ahead, is that, you know, Democrats trying to rally as many Republicans as possible to try to get something done on the DACA front.
And on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue, certainly no White House likes being investigated. It's such a commitment of time and energy and resources. But they do think this House Republicans may overreach, which could be politically beneficial heading into 2024. The Washington Post, Camila DeChalice, thank you so much. Happy Thanksgiving. Still ahead here, and we'll turn to business news. And another big name in the technology sector is cutting thousands of jobs. We'll get an early look at the markets with a live report from CNBC. We'll be right back with that. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It's time now for business news. And for that, let's bring in CNBC's Arabile Gumede, who joins us live from London. Good morning, Arabile. Stock futures slightly up this morning. We just saw a little bit of green on the board. As investors look ahead to the Fed meeting minutes, tell us what we should expect.
Yeah, so that sentiment from the Fed minutes is that really going to set the tone for what could be expected when it comes to those interest rate hikes. Will they begin to slow down? Is that the kind of message that was put forward? It does seem that way initially, but this will perhaps give a much clearer picture as to what exactly the Fed thinks they'll have to do when it comes to interest rates, and how much more, of course, that's dependent on the inflation number, which did sit at 7.7%, which surprised to that downside, which was good news for the economy. But whether that is a sustained approach is going to be the key question mark. So that is what will be looked out for in those Fed minutes. If one takes a look at the Asian market picture, then you did see a sense of markets there going into a little bit of a mixed trading picture there too. Europe has also moved slightly positive as well. We did get PMI numbers coming out of the UK, not getting dramatically better, but certainly not getting any worse either. So markets still looking a little bit fresher today as well.
All right, we'll be watching that. In another headline, HP is the latest tech company to significantly downsize staffing amid this economic downturn. It seems like on a daily basis, there's a tech company laying off people. Tell us what's going on here, and should we be prepared for this trend to continue?
Yeah, Jonathan, look, Ari Melba might actually be very proud of me if I say to him, you know, there is somebody who used to say, another one, right? And that is really the case that we have here with DJ Khaled. Having said that, of course, it is really another tech giant, another company in the tech space that is now laying off consumers. They ran really hard during COVID-19, ramping things up, of course, to try and fit in all those services and the demand that was there from consumers. And now all of them really having to lay off. The latest, of course, as we know today, being HP, 4,000 to 6,000 workers are said to be laid off over the next 3 year period. So it is going to be a gradual process to do that. That saw their shares, however, rise by as much as 1%, particularly in extended trading. But you are getting a sense that this is where they're all going to have to cut to come back to a level that they can perhaps still deal with. But it doesn't mean that those companies aren't growing, because they still are.
And one more for you. Credit Suisse says it could lose about $1.6 billion in the fourth quarter as it undertakes a massive strategic overhaul. Again, that's $1.6 billion. What's going on there?
Yeah, so that's a massive, massive story, particularly out here in Europe. That lender has been fraught with quite a few issues of late, but this strategic overhaul has certainly helped them, or certainly paved a way to what could be a better picture for them, that share price falling more than 5% even today. So perhaps a little bit of skepticism still coming through from a lot of the investors. Really, Credit Suisse now even getting the go-ahead and the green light then from investors to raise capital of around $4 billion. Then, so that was cleared up today. That's a $4.2 billion capital raising, which is set to come out. It was a 98% agreement on the first capital raising and a 92% agreement then by investors to raise capital as well on the second vote too. So clear signs that they are looking to move forward. Of course, you do have the Saudi National Bank expected to get in and its investment into the bank of around 10% there too. So the picture is still going to be very interesting to look out for. No clear signs as yet whether this will be the last of this restructuring for Credit Suisse.
All right, CNBC's Arabella Gomede joining us live from London. Thank you, as always. Still ahead here, we're looking at the mixed results for voter turnout in the midterms and what it might mean for 2024. We'll be right back with that. Nearly 110 million Americans cast a ballot in this year's midterm elections. That's down from the 2018 midterms, when a record-breaking 115 million people went to the polls in total. But key swing states with competitive races saw significant increases in turnout. NBC News calculates that New Hampshire, where Senator Maggie Hassan was able to hold on for re-election, saw a more than 8% increase in turnout. Arizona saw a 7.8% increase. In Pennsylvania, turnout rose 6.6%. And in Michigan, where Governor Gretchen Whitmer was able to fend off Trump-backed Tudor Dixon, turnout was up by more than 5%. States without competitive races and the most populous states in the nation all saw decreases in voter turnout. We should note that these numbers may change slightly as ballots are still being counted in some states. Joining us now, the former mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio. So, Mr. Mayor, thanks for being with us this morning. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Let's start there with the voter turnout. As we just read, turnout for the marquee races spiked down elsewhere. Some of that might be the Trump effect because he wasn't on the ballot, perhaps. But what do Democrats need to do? They obviously have held the Senate. Margin, they're going to lose the House, but by a much smaller margin than many anticipated. Right. They've got some momentum heading into this. How can they continue this going into 24?
Well, look at where the successes were. You know, we saw incredible turnout operations, ground game
in places like Nevada, in places like Arizona, that ultimately made all the difference in the U.S. Senate. So part of this is remembering a Democratic strength historically was field operations. I think in some ways the National Party moved away from that heavy emphasis on consultants and paid advertising. The ground game worked. Nevada, the Culinary Union, famously turned out a huge number of voters. Focus on young people. We saw the voting levels for young people really high in this election, animated by issues like choice, for example, and the extremism of the Republican Party. Focus there, focus on Latinos. That's a constituency growing, obviously, in importance in all elections, but hasn't heard enough from Democrats in enough parts of the country. So I think what this election tells us is there's a lot that can be moved, but you got to bring it literally to people's doorsteps.
So one state, though, where Democrats did not do as well as they had hoped, a state you know best, New York.
Yes.
That is fact. And by some estimations, because of underperformance in the Empire State, that's what cost the Democrats a possibility of hanging on to the House.
Right.
Talk to us about what went wrong here.
A horrible redistricting process, obviously, was the underpinning of it all. It created a lot of confusion and ended up with districts that really were too Republican-friendly. But on top of that, I think we need a different approach in terms of our state Democratic Party, because there's not that ground game I was talking about in New York State. You know, being a primarily blue state, I think bluntly turnout is taken for granted.
Mm-hmm.
But you look across a whole spectrum of demographics, and I start with young people again. That's a group of folks that we know historically may or may not vote in large numbers. In 08 with Obama, we saw stunning youth turnout. Again, really impressive in this last midterm as well. But you got to do something to animate that. That didn't happen in New York State.
So let's turn now to what happened in Colorado Springs. Yeah. Terrible tragedy there at the nightclub. Red flag laws. Analysis by the Associated Press shows that red flag laws are on the books in several states, but are vastly underutilized. Obviously, New York State has tough gun laws. New York City has tough gun laws. So this is an area which you can speak with some expertise. What's your advice to state leaders and jurisdictions to try to better utilize these tools?
Jonathan, this is so important. You can have the law, but if it's not used, it doesn't make much difference. And this horrible tragedy in Colorado Springs, we're seeing a case of this where the police had all the evidence in the world from the previous encounter with this shooter to have gotten that gun away from them. The problem is these laws are porous in many cases. A lot is left up to the individual officer and the individual police department. Here's what I learned from my experience with the NYPD. If you leave the situation gray, it's not surprising that officers are worried that if they do something, they may get in trouble for,
mm-hmm.
that they may be accused of overreaching. Well, if we leave that gray situation, then it's a formula for inaction. Police departments are bureaucracies, too. These laws need to have much clearer triggers, or at least have the ability to have a case looked at a higher level of supervision. That should be mandatory, because it's ridiculous that that gun was there in that home of the shooter. There was an opportunity to get it away. But there was enough gray in that law and the way that that county approached the law that nothing was done. Some mandatory dynamics need to be put in place. One thing that we do find in police departments, if you give them clear, sharp rules, if you say in this case, if there is an accusation someone was going to use that weapon against, say, a family member, there has to be a follow-up process to evaluate whether that weapon should be taken away. Police departments will comply. But if you leave it gray, a lot of people will stand back.
Such an important conversation. And now this morning, we're waking up to news, and we don't know much of the way of details yet about another mass shooting, this time in Virginia. We appreciate you being here. Former mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, we will talk to you again soon. Up here on Way Too Early, troubling new signs that Russia's retreat from southern Ukraine might have only been temporary. We'll get into that. And then coming up on Morning Joe, the latest on that Virginia shooting, another mass shooting in America overnight. We'll get into that. Plus, we're going to hear from the head of the nation's second largest teachers union, Randy Weingarten, after former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo labeled her the most dangerous person in the world. Also ahead on Morning Joe, we're excited about this one. Iconic radio host Howard Stern will join us. Morning Joe will be back. We'll be with Morning Joe soon. We'll be right back on Way Too Early. I'm flustered. Howard Stern's coming.
Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed at home in your Keurig coffee maker with Dunkin' cold K-Cup pods. Just brew it hot over ice and enjoy flavor that's crafted to serve cold. The home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.